Hello and welcome to a new episode of School Must Go On. This time I'm talking to Brandy Yi. Brandy is a professor at various universities and a former school principal in Canada. With her, we are diving into education in Canada, a country that always was at the top of the PISA ratings, and it could have actually rested on that top position. But nevertheless, Canada made a huge shift in the education system. Actually, the whole country has done a 180 in its education system in the last few years. It's not about digital learning today, but about having brought individualized and personalized learning into an entire school system. It's about how students systematically come into contact with universities while they're still at school, how teachers receive at least one day of training every month, or how employers, universities, and career advisors work together at schools. It's also about how the traditional school report cards have been replaced by so-called progress reports, which are based on different aspects, such as growth, progress, and achieved learning goals. It's incredibly inspiring to hear about probably one of the most innovative education systems in the world. Enjoy listening and learning about Canada with Brandy Yi. Hi, Brandy.
Hello, Stefan. How are you?
Good. I'm good. It's only a few hours before Christmas, and I'm super happy we found the time to talk. You are in sunny California, where you teach in Thousand Oaks at California Lutheran University, and I'm super happy that you found the time to talk to me to give our listeners the Canadian perspective. As we've heard in the intro, you've been teaching yourself, you've been a principal for a very long time. And what I read is that you especially like the adolescence, the middle years, as you said it in some article. What's the magic about middle school for you?
Yeah, well, thank you for that. You know, it's interesting, you know, a little bit of background. So when I went through my teacher training program, I was trained as a high school science teacher, so physics, chemistry, and biology. And when I came out of my teacher training program, there were no high school science jobs available. So I had an interview and they said, could you teach, you know, middle school social studies? And being quite naive at the time, I said, well, of course I can. So very quickly, I found out in that first job of mine that those children behaved and interacted with their learning in none of the ways that I had been trained to deal with. And so I learned, you know, within that first week that I was going to need to do my homework and I was going to need to learn all I could about these adolescents, you know, developmentally, you know, the way their brains work, the way their bodies work and how that impacts their learning. So we were going to, if we were going to be able to survive our first year together. And so really, you know, that kind of set off for me, Stefan, you know, a lifelong, you know, I'll say journey, but, you know, really passion for understanding those adolescents, those children of the middle years, you know, what makes them tick and how we can create learning environments to best serve their unique learning needs. So one of the things that, you know, over, you know, throughout my, you know, history as a teacher and a principal and then as a researcher is that it is very important, you know, paramount that, you know, our teachers understand the developmental period of the students that they're working with. And because if we don't do that, there's a lot that happens in neuroscience that can really inform or should inform what we are doing in educational sciences. And I think for a long time, we haven't had those important conversations. And so when I really got into my research, I was looking at, you know, what the neurosciences are telling us, the neurobiology of adolescent development, what's out there and how do we use that so we can ensure that, you know, when we're designing learning for students, when we're designing the learning environment, that it is optimal so those students can thrive. Because research around the world, and it's not just from a Canadian context, but there's certainly a lot of research from Canada to pull from, is that it's really during those middle years that we either hook kids into their learning or where we lose them. You know, and if we lose them, then it becomes really, really difficult to re-engage them.
adolescence years, that's 10 years up until what's the latest age for, is it 19 years or 15 years?
Yeah, for sure. And so, you know, it's interesting, you know, Lawrence Steinberg is an individual, a US researcher that, you know, I've had the privilege of, you know, learning from. And, you know, in a lot of his research and his work, he looks at, you know, throughout the course of history, you know, the idea of adolescence has really changed and, you know, evolved. And some of it is, you know, environmental. So we used to think of adolescence as being, you know, when puberty starts, that's the start of adolescence. And then when it, you know, kind of we move into adulthood and moving out of, you know, the homes of our parents and into, you know, a post-secondary setting, that would be when adolescence ends. And so it's interesting how, you know, we used to look at adolescence as having kind of a biological start and then almost a sociological end.
Yeah, interesting.
But now we're finding that adolescence is starting even earlier. And then, you know, kids are starting into, you know, that the puberty earlier. And then we're looking at, you know, some of those ideas of when families or when, you know, young people, young men and women leave their families has really been extended. And so, yes, you're quite right. It's a long answer to your question. We used to think of it as like a 10 to 19. You know, they're even looking at it as, you know, a 9 almost to 21, 22 right now.
Wow.
And so that really starts to, and, you know, what we see too, and, you know, some of the pieces related to adolescence, we look at, you know, what's going on in the brain, you know, the plasticity of the brain. And when, you know, they start to develop some of those higher order, you know, thinking skills. And, you know, some of those pieces are not, we're seeing them not developing until, you know, later on. So,
Wow. What
that means for us in an educational system, educational setting, is that we really need to understand that. So what we're doing is most effective. You know, I talk a lot about being, you know, developmentally appropriate. You know, we want to provide students always with learning opportunities that I think are authentic, you know, so they're, you know, true to the disciplines that they're studying. You know, so I am not a proponent of, you know, they call it sometimes, you know, the happy, busy, lovely work. So, you know, we'll keep them busy, we'll keep them coloring, you know, it's a quiet, compliant classroom, but there's really no, you know, learning that's going on. So we want it to be authentic to the disciplines that are studying. So what do mathematicians do? So, you know, when scientists engage in, you know, research and they're studying things, what kind of questions do they ask? You know, how do mathematicians look at the world? You know, how do they solve problems? So we want students to be engaged in that authentic work. We want it to be relevant to the world that they're growing up in. And I think that that's probably even more important now as we look at, you know, this pandemic context. So what is relevant to their world? And then we also want it to be developmentally appropriate. You know, quite often we've looked at, you know, looking at designing learning or curriculum for students as being, okay, so if you are 10 and you are in grade 5, that this is the curriculum and this is the content that you should be learning. A lot of that hasn't been revisited in education systems around the world in a really long time. And so we need to make sure that what it is that we're teaching students is developmentally appropriate and relevant to their lives.
Now in Germany, we listen a lot to international comparable data. That's something that for some reason really resonates well with policymakers and administration. So the PISA shock for Germany, the PISA studies every year, and now everyone, of course, wants to understand why do some countries do so well in PISA, and your home country Canada is one of the top performing countries within the OECD and its PISA study. What are the factors that, you know, Germany could focus on, try to, you know, explore the Canadian way of educating, that in your opinion make Canada do so well?
Right. So there's a couple of things I think that are important to recognize with the, you know, international standardized tests of achievement. So there was a researcher by the name of Sharon Friesen that I worked with out of the University of Calgary. And now it seems, I say that the research was in 2009 and it didn't seem like so far away a while ago, but I guess that's over a decade. Yeah. Anyway, she was really curious about a couple of things. She was curious about the adolescence schooling experience in Canada. And, you know, she had the same question. So the idea that, you know, traditionally Canadian students do very well in our PISA tests, but is that, you know, actually being reflected in their learning experience at school. So she engaged in this longitudinal study, and it was studying, you know, adolescents' lived experiences in school. And it was called "What Did You Do in School Today?" And so, which I quite loved. And so, again, asking them about their schooling experience, what she found. And I think that this is always something that we need to pay attention to when we look at, you know, the strength of test scores is, although Canadian students, you know, did very well. And I think it's typically, you know, we're in the top five, you know, in terms of PISA, is what they were showing is that students, you know, the scores ranged differed a little bit during over the course of the study, but over the half of the students in Canada were saying that they were not engaged in school. So they were doing well on standardized tests of achievement, which meant that, you know, there was obviously learning that was occurring. Mm-hmm. But if you break it down very simply, they weren't enjoying being a student. And so the problem with that is that I think that, you know, in a context of today where, you know, they always say that, you know, most of the jobs that we're preparing our students for, you know, that are in school right now don't even exist. So when we don't know what jobs they're going to be pursuing, we need to ensure that our students cannot just regurgitate content, but they have the skills, and abilities, capacities necessary to engage in lifelong learning, to be agile and to be able to pivot, you know, in times when times change, especially during, you know, when we think about the context of this pandemic. And so she looked at engagement further. And I think engagement is one of those words in education that we toss around a lot. You know, are kids engaged? And what does engagement look like? And I think, you know, you talk to 10 different educators and, you know, they would probably have 10 different versions of what engagement in their classroom, you know, what it looks like. Is it quiet and compliant? Is it kids that are excited and answering questions? Is it kids that, you know, can, you know, have, you know, good attendance in class? A variety of things. So in this research in Canada, they broke it down into three different types of engagement, which I think is, you know, quite insightful. So they looked at academic engagement. So would the kids come to school because that was what it's expected of kids? Those are the cultural norms. You know, would they, you know, sit in class? Would they be compliant? Would they raise their hands? Would they follow, you know, those rules of, you know, being in an academic educational setting? Yeah. Then they looked at social engagement. So do kids come to school because it's a social endeavor? You know, they get to see their friends, you know, they get to kind of figure out, you know, the sociological pieces of, you know, developing and how does it, you know, how do you fit in terms of a classroom or relationships and those kinds of things. And then she looked at intellectual engagement. And I think that that's really the key for me. So intellectual engagement is that deep investment in learning, that kids come to school because they're so excited about what they're learning. And when I talk about it with my students and with my staff, I talk about it as sticky learning, right? So they come to school, they're so excited, you know, the learning opportunities that the teachers have provided them with are so authentic and connected to things that they're excited about. And they want to go home and they want to talk about it at the dinner table with their families. And then they want to research it more at night. And then they want to come back to school. And they want to talk about it with their teacher. That's sticky learning, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so what we want is we want kids to be intellectually engaged, that deep investment, because we know that that will cause them or create in them that sense of being lifelong learners. And so yes, the PISA scores are important, but we need to look at that, you know, also with the lens of, are the kids engaged? Can they not only do well on standardized tests of achievement, but have we created an environment where the kids want to be continuous learners? And I think in Canada, that's one of the things that we've been successful at doing as well. And I think that that also needs to be looked at. So yes, the PISA scores, but we need to look at how do we create students that are intellectually engaged and motivated to be learners? And so those initial results showed that our kids, like over half the kids, weren't necessarily intellectually engaged. And so we really looked at what it is that we were missing and what it is that we weren't doing. And I think what it caused us, you know, is, you know, Germany had the PISA shock. You know, we had a little bit of this shock in Canada that, okay, so we've looked at the scores, we've said that the scores show us that we're doing well. So we really haven't then, you know, engaged in any kind of deep examination of what we're doing in schools. We've just thought that the PISA scores told us that we were doing well, so we're just going to keep doing the same thing. And that showed us that we needed to start to shift what we were doing. And so we really started to, you know, I think across all levels of education, so whether it was the K-12 system or the university systems, in terms of looking at what do we need to do to support our students, so we're not just recreating those very industrial, you know, models of education in our schools where, you know, everyone is doing the same thing, everyone is learning the same curriculum, everyone is learning, you know, doing the same tests, you know, those kinds of things. And how do we really individualize and personalize our education systems for our students and for our teachers as well, so we can ensure that they have the skills that they need? And I think that we've had that, you know, 10 to 15 year kind of journey in revamping some of those pieces as well.
And in a very positive way, I would love to squeeze you like a lemon to learn all about how you individualized and personalized the learning experience, not in just a few lighthouse project schools, but in scale. Yeah, that's what I find so fascinating. And you said it took a decade or so to get there. I believe Germany is 2 to 2.5 decades away from being there. And during my research for this podcast, I learned so much about university credits that you can earn during school and jumping from one school to another and just doing courses in different schools and so on and so on. I don't want to say too much. Maybe you can walk us through the different milestones of this path over a decade or so that Canada took to individualize the learning experience.
Yeah, certainly. You know, so I think that it, you know, as you know, I had mentioned before, you know, as much there was the PISA shock in Germany, this data that came out of this What Did You Do in School Today study really forced us to reconsider the things that we were doing that we thought were serving our population well. And so one of the things we looked at was the existing systems that we had in place. And so in most cases, and again, you know, Canada is similar to Germany in that we don't really have a federal system of education, you know, in terms of where, you know, the federal government, you know, exists, is that, you know, all students are guaranteed a free basic public education, right? Then each of the provinces in our three territories, they have their own governments that, you know, govern education systems within those provinces. So you will see, you know, a little bit of variation among the provinces. So I just wanted to kind of keep that in mind. But what we had in general is that we had, you know, educational structures and systems that served an industrial period. And it served the industrial age well, because we were preparing workers for, you know, very, you know, factory jobs, you know, where they had to be, they had to be compliant and they had to be able to follow directions. And, you know, it was very procedural, you know, and so it served that system, you know, that time well. But, you know, fast forward, and we started to look at things, and I was, you know, part of some of, you know, the key stakeholder groups that were, you know, we engaged in some pretty uncomfortable conversations about what is it that we are doing, and why are we still doing some of those things that were for a time that does not exist anymore. And so we looked at the tremendous rigidity that we had in our education system. And so our education system served students well, that were generally, they were good students, that they were very compliant, that they could follow, you know, directions and instructions from teachers. But if you didn't fit into that mold, you know, like if you weren't, you know, and I hate to use the word academic and non-academic, but I'll use that and then I'll explain it. But if you weren't a traditionally like academic kid who did very well in, you know, like the core subjects, which would be, you know, language arts and mathematics and, you know, history and science, if you weren't that academic kid, then there was really no place for you in our education system. And it was hard for us to come to terms with that we had created structures within our system that only served some of our students well. And so we needed to look at what it is that we were going to do differently. So we looked at, you know, our high schools first, because I think that they were, you know, some of the easiest places to look at. How would we restructure our high schools in a flexible way to individualize and personalize learning. So we would ensure that more of our students were not dropping out of high school, that they were transitioning into a post-secondary setting. And not only that, that they were like, so we used to look at it at K to, as K to 12. Then we started to look at it as K to post-secondary. You know, how do we look at that transition, you know, from grade 12 into post-secondary. And then we started to look at it even further, Stefan, in terms of how do we transition students well out of some kind of credential in post-secondary into a workplace setting. And those pieces became really key for us. So, you know, I'll use some examples to illustrate this. We started to develop, and this is, you know, I'll speak from a context in Alberta, but this was happening across Canada. With our with our high schools and our post-secondary institutions, we started to develop partnerships. So high school students could start to take university credit. You know, the university environment, anything that is unknown tends to be, you know, create some kind of uncertainty or scary. And there was a long time where, you know, some students in high school would say, you know, I could never make it in a university or post-secondary setting. So I'm not even going to go there. And so we started to create opportunities within our high schools where they could start to take some of those preliminary university courses, that the universities would cover the tuition of that because they saw it as an advantage that if they could get kids hooked into, you know, university is a real possibility for me, that they would then get students that would enroll in their universities. And so we had students in high school that were starting to earn university credit that was at no cost to them. Then they were starting to develop relationships with those universities. And so there's that loyalty that starts to happen. And then we started to think about it as one step further. So, you know, for example, we had a student, like if you had a student that was, let's say, interested in engineering. So in high school, they would start to take some of those, you know, preliminary mathematics and, you know, engineering kind of courses. And then we started to look at how we could bring in mentors from industry. So those people that were already engineers in large engineering firms, and how we would connect those professionals in with our students. And so now you had a student who is connected into the university, you know, shows loyalty into that university system, but then they're also connected with mentors who are in industry. And so now we have that alignment, right? So we're supporting the students as they transition, you know, from high school into post-secondary, and then we're supporting them with that, you know, those key connections as they transition from post-secondary into the workforce. And so what we found, you know, after, you know, decade plus of doing this, is that we have students that are transitioning well into university, that are successful in university, and that are transitioning well into the workforce and that are staying in the workforce. And what we hear from, you know, our partners in the workforce is that they have, you know, now employees that are loyal, right? You know, because they have those connections with them. And so that has been very, very successful for us.
So I'm a sociologist by training. Sorry for interrupting. Mm-hmm. And I found it fascinating, the idea to softly let students, high school students, get in touch with the university system, especially those out of lower social economic classes who have no parents who've gone to university or college. That can be such a social mobility booster, upwards social mobility for people. Was it just a theory, or does it just work in theory? Meaning that, well, if you look at the data, it's probably it might be a lot of middle class kids who would have gone to university anyhow. Now they finish 1 year earlier because they've gathered so many bachelor credit points already during high school. Or could you actually make this work to have kids benefit from this who wouldn't usually end up at college or university? Did it work, or did you have to facilitate it and add some extra ingredient to the recipe, like counseling sessions, or I don't know what else to do to make it work?
So, you know, it did work, you know, and I think that as anything, you know, when you approach it from, you know, whether the sociological perspective or any kind of scientific perspective, you know, you lay out what you think is going to work, what the ingredients are going to be, and then you see what else you need to add afterwards. And so, you know, one of the things I think that we've thought for a long time, you know, especially with, you know, some of those students that, you know, are very capable, you know, in terms of, you know, their grades academically of going to post-secondary, but that haven't been able to, you know, because of, you know, the financial situation that their families find themselves in, is that they learn very early that there's no real sense of them even hoping or having aspirations of going to post-secondary because it's not a real thing for them, right? You know, so very early on, you know, and we started to do some research into that, and, you know, as early as, you know, elementary school, grade five or grade six, you know, students based on their, you know, current socioeconomic kind of environment will start to make decisions about what is possible for them, you know, career-wise, which is really, really unfortunate. Right, kind of thing. And so what we started to do is that, you know, initially we looked at, you know, high school flexibility and, you know, what that would look like and how we would open up partnerships. And we opened up partnerships, not just with our universities, but with, you know, some of our trades and technical schools and our art schools as well, you know. And so, you know, I'll explain that a little bit more later. So that opened, you know, post-secondary up to not just the kids that were university bound, you know, for traditional bachelor's programs, but it opened up, you know, post-secondary opportunities for kids who wanted to go in and, you know, become, you know, electricians or mechanics or, you know, work in, you know, the aeronautics, you know, industry, those kinds of things. And so now, you know, a life beyond the high school started to take shape and form for many students. We started to look at career counseling at a much earlier age. So we started to do that in the middle school. And we started to look at, you know, providing opportunities for our universities, mentors to come into our middle schools to start to work with those kids. Because again, we wanted to start to change some of those attitudes with those children who thought that, you know, post-secondary university was not possible for them. We wanted to start to shift some of those attitudes. And so we, again, it was, you know, in terms of the ingredients, it was a lot of things. So a lot of it was a mental shift, you know, and we looked at, you know, the mentorship relationships is something that I think that we have not paid enough attention to in terms of, you know, all kind of holistic support of our students. So how do we provide them with academic support? How do we provide them, you know, with mentorship support? And, you know, and sometimes there might be some financial support that is provided there as well. But we kind of blew up the model of what we thought was a traditional, you know, you go from elementary school to middle school to high school, you follow a prescribed curriculum. Everyone does the same thing at the same time. You know, we move kids from grade to grade, you know, based on, you know, age, not necessarily on the developmental readiness, which is another thing that I think is something we need to look at some point. And then we hope that they do well. And if they don't, then we don't consider it necessarily a failing of the system. We consider it a failing of the child. And so the environment what we have created, I think, is very much a strength-based model that we look at what every child needs in order to succeed and how we as a system, how it is our responsibility to ensure that we provide the conditions for each child to succeed. And I think that was a shift. What was also important is that, you know, and as a principal for, you know, as long as I was a principal, I started to think of, yes, you know, how do I support the students within my school, but how do I support my teachers in supporting the students in the school? And, you know, I think that that's something that we don't necessarily pay enough attention to. When we should. So asking teachers to support students working in new ways, when teachers themselves don't know how to work in those ways, it's a pretty punitive form of leadership, right? And so how do we support the teachers in working in new ways with students? And how do we ensure that the students feel capable in the new system, but also that the teachers feel that they are capable in the new system? And, you know, we always like to think about accountability, like how do I hold people accountable? And certainly there's a piece of that. I always like to think about it as how do we hold people capable, you know, and what it was my job as a leader to ensure that my teachers had the support, the resources, the time that they needed to be able to work in these new ways. And so one of the things that we do very well in Canada that was different than, you know, what I saw in Germany or when I was in Finland as well, is that we provide teachers with the time to do the things that we're asking them to do. So mm-hmm. we have, you know, guaranteed by our teacher contracts is a minimum of one professional learning day every month. And so it might not seem like a lot, but it is. The gift
it
of
is.
Time,
it is a lot.
Yeah. You know, the gift of time is very, very important. And so one professional learning day a month where we could come together as a staff or where teachers could come together in small groups and say, you know, I need to look at how I design learning differently for students or how I can connect with, you know, partners in, you know, the university to better understand what's happening in the university so I can better prepare my students so they can transition well into the university environment. It shifted the culture, you know, it shifted the culture in terms of this whole new possibility for teachers in that I'm not just the deliverer of curriculum, I'm not just the deliverer of content, but yes. my job is really how is it that I support my students, you know, beyond the walls of my classroom. And so the things I saw in the shift that started to take place, the renewed passion for teaching that I saw in my teachers, where we kind of started to, you know, literally break the molds of what they thought, you know, was kind of the parameters of their job, was actually, you know, I think about it now and I kind of, you know, get kind of goosebumps and chills because the things, the learning that they started to design for their students was unbelievable. You know, they would, so I'll give you an example. So we had a teacher, I think it was grade 8 science, where they were looking at structures and forces and aerodynamics. And it happened to be the Winter Olympics during this time. And so the teacher asked me, you know, during this professional learning day, is it okay that I go in to the university and I connect with the professors that are working in the kinesiology lab? And I start to, and I start to understand what it is that they're doing there and, you know, how it is that relates to what my students are doing and how it provides a real world kind of backdrop context to, you know, these principles that we're learning in class. And I said, absolutely. And so, you know, she went and she was working with the university and then, you know, basically they came back and she was designing these learning experiences for students. And so the end point was that the students were supposed to take one of the Olympic events and they were supposed to design either equipment for them or they were supposed to, you know, look at how they would change their body shape, you know, so they could be more effective, you know, so they could improve their performance. Wow. And so when you give students those big open-ended questions like that, you have opportunities for all students to find a place where they would feel successful rather than the teacher saying, okay, I want you to write a paper on the aerodynamics of a ski jumper, right? You know, which changes the learning very different, you know, it changes it. And so those students, they started to look at, you know, the people that are in the luge event, how they point their toes and what their helmets are like and their body shape. And they looked at a variety of different things. And then the university invited our students over to present their findings to the professors at the university. And so for students to be able to go into this environment to speak, you know, and I had the, you know, pleasure of going with them to speak with, you know, with confidence and conviction on what they've learned and to say, you know, I really think that, you know, you should do this. And the people in the luge, their helmet should be more shaped like this to give them, you know, more aerodynamics and it might, you know, cut some time, you know, off their runs. And then for the university professors to, you know, invite them into the human performance lab and to look at, you know, some of the testing that they do, you know, on, you know, whether it's, you know, different kinds of, you know, equipment that they use or on athletes when, you know, they're doing the people that are doing the bobsled, how they start, you know, the race, you know, it shifts that learning into not seat work where they're, you know, reading chapters and answering questions, but they're engaging in real world activity. And those connections for the students, for the teachers, it has reinvigorated, I think, the education system in ways that we had not imagined possible.
Yeah, and as I said before, I find what I hear sounds like a story from an avant-garde school, private school, reform school, but not like the typical state-run middle school or high school. And there's more that I learned on my research. I learned about individual student learning plans, and I learned about progress reports instead of simple outdated report cards. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit more on these new inventions of the Canadian school system.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm just going to go back to address the other comments. So I think that, you know, not every day can be a day where you go to the university and present to professors, right? And, you know, plan the human performance lab. And that's not realistic. But I think that the atmosphere of education is that we want teachers to, you know, and I'll take a, you know, phrase from Brené Brown, but to dare greatly, you know, to be courageous.
Courageous,
and to bring back a joyfulness into the classroom and a joyfulness into learning. So we have, again, I go back to, we have, you know, broken those molds of what we thought had to be, and we shifted into a mindset of what could be and what is possible. And so I think that the classrooms are less, you know, even when you walk into the classrooms, they're less rigid. You know, you can feel that the students are more comfortable, that students are more comfortable making mistakes, that teachers are more comfortable, you know, trying things out, you know, trying to find ways to engage with their learners. I think that the partnerships that we have created with, you know, the community, with the universities, with the high school flexibility, allowing kids to move from one high school to the next, because, you know, one high school might have an amazing culinary facility and the student wants to be a chef and the other one doesn't. It's created an atmosphere where of possibility.
I believe I would dare to say that it also creates happier teachers, because I got this it's a picture I think that in my head always when I think about adaptive learning programs, practically the vision. I got this hate love relationship with the vision to put teaching on autopilot and have an algorithm choose the next the next learning item for a child, because it takes away so much fun of the teaching. Because so much fun about being a teacher is to think about how am I going to engage my students, my class, maybe just a few students tomorrow, and make them excited about a certain subject. And if you just put the program on autopilot, you won't get this. And so I totally see that courageous teachers. Yeah, it's amazing. I would just love to talk with you over a whole podcast about how to bake courageous teachers. Yeah, what's the recipe? It's fantastic.
Well, there's a couple of signs that I have in my office that I think are always important that I go back to. So, you know, the children are the curriculum, which I think is very important, right? Kind of thing. So what is going on in their lives? And good teachers can make anything a lesson and to make it connected and relevant. You know, and the other thing I always go back to, it's in a context for a purpose. So I think that that's a lens that we always need to look at. So what are we teaching? You know, what's the context and what is the purpose of it? How do we make it relevant and connected to the kids' lives? But I'll go back to you'd asked about individualized program plans and you talked about, you know, progress reports. You know, that was an interesting piece for us as well, as we started to examine how it goes back to two things. So it goes back to the assessment process and it goes back to how do we communicate student learning. And so, you know, as in many places of the world, we would, you know, depending on the way that your school was, you know, the schedule of the school, you would, you know, inevitably, you know, create report cards, and report cards would go home. They would show parents, you know, students, you know, learning. And it was very much I feel that it was a deficit based model. Like I never felt like our report cards or progress reports, that they showed students' strengths. It was always a finality. It was a period. It was, you know, this is a child. It was a mark. It was an A. It was a 72. And there was no communication that occurred. And I understood that, or understand that there's, you know, a legality piece, that our report cards here are a legal document and we need to produce them. And there is accountability, you know, for teachers behind that. But I never really could quite understand who the audience was supposed to be or what the intention was, other than it was just something that we had to do because we've always done it. And so one of the things we started to examine is, you know, we started to look at assessment. We started to look at formative assessment, you know, so that ongoing formative assessment and feedback loops, you know, and how do we use it not just to provide information to students on what it is that they can or cannot do, but how do we use it as teachers to inform our next steps in our instruction? So, you know, for a long time, summative assessment was what kind of was the main form of assessment that we used. Teachers would teach a unit, they would give a test, the students would write a paper, and then we would move on. And so it's interesting because that was something that we just accepted as that's the acceptable practice. But when you actually say it out loud and you start to unpack that, it runs, I think, quite counterintuitive to the teaching and learning process. So if we have a learning outcome and it is important that all students, it's important enough that it's, you know, the lawmakers someplace have put it into our curriculum, you know, and what it is that we need to teach students. And if the learning outcome is important and we only test students on that learning outcome at the end by indicated by a test and they shows that either, you know, they get an A or an 82 or a 94. And so they've sort of met the learning outcome, or they get a 60 or a 50 or 40, which means that they maybe haven't quite met the learning outcome. What happens the next day, Stefan? Well, we move on to the next unit, that's crazy to me. You know, if it's important that students meet the learning outcome, then it's important that all students meet the learning outcome. And so we needed to shift how we looked at assessment. And so, you know, we started to think about, not being so that we couldn't be so rigid in how students would meet the learning outcome or the timing of what they would meet the learning outcome. You know, and we know that, you know, you think take a classroom of 30 students. Well, you know, developmentally, you know, They're at all different stages, you know, both physically and mentally, cognitively. So to think that, you know, on December 22nd, because I had put it in my unit plan that every student would be able to solve, you know, a quadratic equation would be quite silly, right? But if it's important that in, you know, grade 9 mathematics, that by the end of the year, all students be able to, you know, solve a quadratic equation, then the teacher needs to provide that ongoing feedback and support to ensure that that learning outcome is met. So we started to shift the way that we communicated student learning. And so I think that there's three important concepts that we started to include in a progress report. And so we started to tease that out in terms of student growth, progress, and achievement. And cool. I think that it showed three things, or it highlighted for, I think, our families and for our students and teachers, different things, but that were all very important. So when we think about student growth, every student based on, you know, how they were born and their cognitive capacities will have growth within an academic year that is different. To think that they will all achieve one grade level or progress one grade level in one year is not scientifically, you know, sound, right? Some may progress more than one grade during a year, some may progress less. And so we looked at student growth. So in relation to their own growth or to their own potential, how is that child doing, right? And I think that was important for our teachers to be able to tease out, because they started to need to understand their individual students in a very different way. Then we looked at progress. So we looked at progress towards the intended learning outcomes. So based on provincial or national standards, if all children in grade 5 by the end of the year should be able to write a narrative essay, where is that child in December in terms of their growth towards that, you know? And so they're not there yet, perhaps, but are they moving towards being able to meet that outcome by the end of the year? Yes, they are. Or no, they're not. Or this is what we're going to do to support the student. And then we look at achievement, you know? So what is the snapshot right now of how the child is achieving? And I think that, you know, it shifted the way that we communicated learning because it showed students as being capable. If you looked at a traditional report card where teachers would just, you know, throw out a grade that was based on, you know, an average of, you know, tests and papers and assignments throughout the course of the term, not all students, and some students may work very, very hard, but will never see any kind of positive feedback. Right. And so when we tease it out in terms of growth, progress and achievement based on that individual student learning plan, that individualized plan of learning for that student, then students started to see themselves as capable. This way parents saw their student and their role in supporting their students started to shift. And then we also found that teachers needed to know and started to be able to know their students in deeper ways in order to create a learning environment that best supported their needs.
Yeah. So what I find so fascinating is we learned about a lot of innovative ideas, progress reports, individual student learning plans, the connection between the college, the university and the school. There's a lot of counseling happening. So there's a lot of progressive ideas out there. But for shift to happen, 50% of the genius is to actually have these ideas. The other 50% of the genius is to actually implement these new ideas into an existing education system against a lot of forces that are against you, conservative political opposition. There's maybe teacher unions who want to protect their teachers from working overtime, too much change in a very short period of time. Maybe there's even families, citizens who benefited from the old system and who are afraid that they're going to lose something in the new system. So can you tell us a little bit about how Canada implemented the shift, the change in such a large dimension as we learned so far?
Yeah, certainly. So I think probably the first thing that comes to mind, Stefan, is, you know, I talked about it before. It was giving people the time that they needed to do this, right, kind of thing. And so a shift on this scale, which is, you know, wasn't a small shift, you know, it was a significant, I don't know if it was a complete 180, you know, but it certainly it was a significant departure from the way that we thought about teaching and learning before. We needed to give people time to come to terms with that. And so when we talk about engaging stakeholders, you know, I was in a process of working with, you know, students, with parents, with teachers, with community partners, in looking at how do we, you know, it's one thing to ask people to do something, but how do we provide them with every tool we possibly can in order for them to be successful? And so the gift of time, you know, obviously was one of those. Again, going back to asking teachers to do something that they don't have the knowledge to do, they don't have the time to do, they don't feel that they have the resources or support to do, that is a very punitive form of instructional leadership. And so, you know, I always talked about, you know, in a school, how do you set the stage? How do you create the conditions for the students to be successful? We needed to kind of, you know, elevate a little more in terms of how do we create the conditions for the system, for our teachers to be successful. We engaged in a study in it, and it seems like not so long ago, but it is. And it basically, we put out to the entire population of what would it mean to be an educated, you know, citizen in the year 2025. Now, 2025 is not so far away right now. Yeah. But, you know, we heard voices from hundreds of thousands of people, and it was students probably that presented the most compelling voice. In terms of what it is that they were hopeful for in our education system and what it is that they were most fearful for in terms of being able to go out into the world and to thrive, and how they did not feel that our current education system was preparing them well. I think that the voice of the students was one of the biggest drivers in the need for change. And I think the voice of the students was probably the most critical factor in, you know, waking people up, shaking people up into the necessity for change. You know, I think in education systems, with the best of intentions, you know, we have a lot of conversations about what we think is best for students, you know, always wanting, you know, to do what's best for students, but we don't involve students in those conversations, you know, and I think that their voice is always important. I think for the shift for us, their voice was critical.
And was there a way to broadcast the voice of students in a way that the average Canadian citizen could participate?
Yes. So, you know, the McKinsey report was one of the reports that came out of, what does it mean to be an educated citizen in 2025? Mm-hmm. The student voice was very much reflected in that report. And that report very much became the driving force behind, wow. Some major policy documents. One of the policy documents, and the name escapes me right now, but I'll think of it as I continue talking. The intent of the document is, for lack of a better term, it's our marching orders as teachers, right? So as an education system, what is it? It was a ministerial order on student learning. Mm-hmm. And so it basically laid the vision out for what it is that we are going to do and why. And after this extensive consultation process, with stakeholders, teachers, parents, but the student voice, which was key, we moved from an old ministerial order that was very much, students will need to learn their multiplication tables and students will need to be able to identify the geography of Canada, those pieces that were very, very factual, very knowledge-based, a regurgitation of, pretty traditional forms of knowledge. It moved to something that when I talk about it now, still excites me. So it says that we will create engaged thinkers, students who are engaged thinkers, who are ethical citizens with a spirit of entrepreneurship and curiosity. And I thought, wow, when you think about an education system that wants to create students that have those skills and capacities and abilities, that's a game changer, right? It really is in terms of how that shifted what it is that we believed was important in teaching and learning. And it really gave us the permission, I think, that we needed, Stefan, to be courageous and to dare greatly, in terms of our endeavors as a country.
It's amazing. I think so much of it is out there in Germany, too. We've just had Germany's largest education hackathon, where mm-hmm. thousands of students, parents and teachers and also employers worked on the ideal school or the ideal outcome of our education system. But politics and also administration seem to be so stubborn. Yeah, it's out there. Other countries are doing it, but it seems like no one really gets moving. It's fascinating that in Canada, these forces, they've listened, they've heard, they've seen the need, yeah, and they've yes. actually started to act on it, to implement change. That's fascinating.
Well, and I think too, you look at a couple of things. I always remember it was probably a conference I was at. It was maybe 15 years ago. It was the DeFours that were doing a conference related to professional learning communities. But it's something that has stuck with me, that you need to present evidence sometime that is so compelling that it would make it almost morally reprehensible to not engage in whatever it is. And I think that, and you never want to use students as, an excuse or, the faces that are going to tug at people's heartstrings. But we've given students a voice in their education. It's that student agency in their learning in ways that we never had before. And what we have seen in return, I think in terms of, a societal perspective, when you look at, governments that are, concerned about, budgets and, all of those things and, people that can, contribute to the, workforce and taxpayers and those kind of things. We have a young population now that is entering into the workforce, that they're moving now into post-secondary, that they're entering into the workforce, they're more satisfied in the workforce, they're thriving, they are contributing to, the country. And, I'll have to say it because unfortunately it boils down to that. They're contributing to the economy in a way that makes us stronger. And so I think sometimes policymakers look at that and they say, okay, it's working. How do we continue to support this?
Yeah, that's also something I found in my research was that there's a very, very progressive, very open public debate about how to make Canada's school system future ready, looking at growing competition from primarily East Asian economies and how to actually prepare the Canadian society for it. And it's fantastic to see that you've mastered the shift. So now that the shift is done, what's next? What's the next frontier for such an innovative society that embraces change in the education system so well? Is there another big wave coming?
Well, I think a couple of things. What's next is that I never want us to become complacent. I think that we found ourselves in the place that we were in because we got complacent. We looked at, test scores that were positive test scores. And, I think that had we only taken at face value what those PISA scores showed us, we probably wouldn't have engaged in the really necessary work that was needed to be done that has brought us to the place that we are right now. What's next for us? I think, really a couple of things. The world, post-pandemic or whatever stage of the pandemic that we're in right now, it's introduced digital learning technologies to us in a way that we never, I think, thought we would have to interact with. And I think some of that shift has been needed. Some of it's been positive. I just think that we need to, we need to delve further into the world of online blended synchronous learning and the role that that can play in, not necessarily as an alternative to face-to-face learning, because I always believe, the relationships that teachers form with their students and how teachers connect their students to their learning is something that is not as easily done in an online learning environment, nor can it be done with any kind of, AI technology. But we need to look at, as a whole, as society, I think, the role of technology in learning moving forward and how we use that in a wise way.
So from my research, you already do much more than the average OECD country out there. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I would love to get a glimpse of your imagination. If you could draw a picture of the Canadian school in, let's say, 5 years from now, 2026, or if you want to say 2030, that's also fine. What is it that that digital learning will actually have changed by then?
Yeah, interesting. Oh, if you gave me the money, Stefan, what I would do with my school. Uh-huh. I see the school as a hub, right? I always think of the school as being a hub. And in one of the schools I was at, we shifted our library from a traditional library where, students would come in and check out books and it would be quiet, reading kind of time, to what I call the learning commons. And I see that as a potential for, a model of our schools for the future. So the idea of the learning commons is that it was a flexible, dynamic, exciting learning space where students would come in to connect out, with people that were out there, experts, I would have students that would come in and they were, studying, the Renaissance. And so they would come into our learning commons and, we were fortunate enough to have, grants from, Apple Canada at the time. And so we had fabulous technology. So they would come in and they would connect out with some of the, gallery curators at the Uffizi, gallery in Florence, and they would be walking them through, some of the, masterpieces. And, I see always there being a need for teachers and a physical school. But I think the shifting of the notion of what a physical school is, I like the idea of a hub that kids come in, they connect with trusted adults. Those adults, can facilitate their questions and point them in the direction of how it is that they can reach out to other places, other sources to pursue those unique passions. One of the things that I always said to my students at the end of the year, and I don't know why I still get emotional when I think about it, but I always said to my students, and I truly believe it, Stefan, is that each of my students have a unique gift that no one else on this planet has. And my job as a school principal, our job as teachers, is to help you discover what that gift is, so then you can go back and contribute to the world in a way that no one else can. And I really think that if we look at our schools through that lens, in terms of supporting students in developing their gifts so they can contribute back, we shift the idea of a traditional school and a schooling system, perhaps.
Fantastic. And again, teachers will have to also adapt and change and learn new things of learning. I was wondering when you said that you give teachers the gift of time and there's a lot of time for PD, professional development. Don't you also have a teacher shortage in Canada? And it's very tough to actually let teachers go on trainings and workshops and develop their own style of teaching. How can you manage a shortage in the teacher workforce and at the same time a lot of investment in professional development?
Yeah, and I think that so there's been an ebb and flow in terms of, you know, the number of teachers that we have. I think that what we've started to see since we've looked at new ways of teaching and learning and new ways of supporting teachers, you know, teachers as being, you know, ongoing learners as well. How do we support teachers throughout their career? Is it, you know, we used to look at, you know, and, you know, the statistic is roughly within the first 5 years of their career, we would lose 50% of our teachers. That was, you know, that was roughly, you know, what the statistic was. You know, that has shifted significantly because we've shifted, you know, the conditions around teaching and learning, you know, and so the statistic is, you know, probably up to, you know, we have, you know, maybe we're only losing a third to a quarter of the teachers, which is, you know, a significant improvement in the over the course of a decade.
Yeah.
And then we're looking at, you know, training our teachers in different ways so they are better prepared for the classrooms. Wow. And I think that has, you know, shifted that teacher shortage that we once saw.
Amazing. Brandy, I would love to continue talking, but I've stolen so much of your time already. So
well, perhaps we can continue again sometime.
Yes, it would be great. Professor Brandy Yi, thank you so much. Say hello to the Californian sun and thanks for all the amazing inspiration today.
Thanks so much, Stefan. I appreciate the time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of School Must Go On. For updates and news, you can subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. If you would like to send me ideas or comments, shoot me an email to podcast@sofatutor.com. I'm also happy to discuss and connect on Twitter and LinkedIn.